Thank you for joining us in our last presentation of the day. To close this journey, I'm glad to introduce Esteban Pereira. He's professor at Andrés Hurtado University with a presentation entitled Contractual Detachment and the Intrinsic Value of the Contract. Your time, Esteban.
Thank you very much, Marinella. I am very happy to be here in Girona. In this presentation, I will offer a critical view of the Riquimel thesis according to which the intrinsic value of the contract is the personal detachment between the contracted parties. This thesis, as we know, has been influential in the philosophy of contract law. The presentation will be developed in three sections. First, I will briefly depict a Riquimel detachment thesis. Second, I will offer an overview of normative foundation of contract law as elaborated by the philosophy of contract law. Thirdly, I will critically address the question whether contractual detachment can be the intrinsic value of contract in the accordance with its unitary commitment on the individualistic normative foundation. First, the detachment thesis. As we know, Riquimel deals with the relationship between promise of contract by attempt to dissociate both terms. He suggests that despite their congruous and common instrumental function, there are opposite value at stake and be clearly set that apart. Where promises contribute to strength, then the personal relationship between the participant of the practice contract aims to achieve two opposite, the intrinsic value of contract bond to detach the contractor parties of each other. That promise help in the strengthen personal relationship and then, in turn, contract help to maintain the distance between the parties. Certainly, this suggests the extinction of the opposite value, which, when viewed of the different perspectives, are both desirable. In some contexts, it's valuable to strengthen personal ties, but in the others, it's not better to blur relationship planes and extend maintenance of the distance between participants. Individuals have different life plans, and in accordance with this plan, they make decisions. A lone individual enjoy greater freedom to choose with bond established and maintained of the personal relationship. This more valuable he has become. In this way, the main value of detachment is the possibility to establish relationship without the need to get personally involved. According to Riquimel, the value of detachment lies in constitute an option, not a predicament, and as such, is a valuable and the alternative to dependence on present and future relationship, personal relationship. Contract, therefore, makes it possible for the contracted parties to depend on previous or subsequent personal ties. This allows differentiate between contract and promise. A contract does not come into the existence as a promise, but rather as a mechanism to replace it. People turn to the contract as an open option for the fulfilling need of having personal relationship. Contracted parties do not depend on having a personal relationship with each other, which prevent their other affair from also become interfused. They are merely parties in the contract, not friends. Their bonds is defined by the detachment that the contractor option ensure. By means of contract, the law offers a genuine alternative to promise. Such an option forces the freedom of the contractor parties as long as they enjoy the freedom, do not depend on present or future personal relationship between them. This threshold of freedom as the research thanks to the detachment and can be maintained by the contractor parties. Riquimel thinks if they so wish. If, on the contrary, they prefer to blur the roles and abandon the detachment that the contractual bonds facilitate, they can do so, leaving the contract and making use of the personal tight relationship frameworks to mediate between them. The intrinsic value of the contract resides, therefore, in the personal detachment between the contractor parties. Against Fried, the contract is not a promise because contract constitutes a substitute for promise. In this way, seeming the contract is a promise to simplify its value and operation. 2. Normative foundation of contract law. The question about normative foundation of contract law constitutes a primary concern for the philosophical reflection of contract law. Here, individualism has occupied an hegemonic position. According to the traditional thesis, private law, and especially contract law, is a matter of individualism. The difficulty of this thesis lies in the fact that many times the term individualism is not elucidated. In addition, this perspective is based on a monistic understanding model of contract law. That is to say, individualism is the common normative foundation of the different concerns of private law. As will be shown, there is not only one way to understand the individualistic foundation, nor is entirely clear that there is a single normative foundation of contract law. Regarding individualism, it is possible to distinguish between at least two persons. I will label them as follows: selfish individualism and disinterested individualism. A significant aspect both reading of individualism have in common is the division of self-instrument and the instrument of others. Self-instrument is different from the instrument held by others. From this demarcation, it argued in favor of a strong preference of the self-instrument. Agent must ensure the satisfaction to the greatest possible extent of their own instrument without having the duty of ensure that the instrument of the other also fulfilled. This approach of social relationship has application in various areas of private law, as is evident in the law of contract. In the contract field, for example, a contracting party should only attend to their own interests and maximize the benefits obtained through the contractual relationship without being concerned about the other contracting party interest. The principle of autonomy of the will provides the significant support to the individualistic proprietor. In this sense, the contractor party is not only obligated to perform the services they have agreed to perform and must not perform action which, even if they increase the satisfaction of the other party interests, are not covered by the contractual agreement invited by them. The autonomy of the will requires the contractor party to observe everything to which he has agreed autonomy, but it depends with the other possible demands that are beyond the individual sphere of the agent and they will be beneficial for the other contractor parties. Parties to the contract seek to comply with the agreement, but not necessary to act in the strength of the other party, if this is not part of the contract. Along with the convergence regarding the separation of interests and the predominance of the personal interests over other interests, we find a discrepancy between both ways of seeing individualism. This rests on the way in which the agent relates to others or, in other words, the way in which the pursuit of personal interests is combined with the respect of other interests. Selfish and disinterested individualism address other interests differently. While the first approach exacerbates the primacy of the self-interest, neglecting the barrier to achieve its satisfaction, the second reconciles the pursuit of the self-interest with the due protection of other interests. From this perspective, the satisfaction of the interests of the agent is incompatible with the infringement of the rights and interests of the other members of the community. Fulfilling the greatest interest does not authorize or validate causing harm to others. Duncan Kennedy has characterized the core of individualism philosophy as follows. The essence of individualism is the making of a sharp distinction between one instrument and those of the other, combined with the belief that a preference with the conduct for one's own interest is legitimate, but there are should be failing to respect the rules that make it possible to coexist with the other similarly self-interest. End of the note. This approach has two main features. First, it stipulates on the basis of the differentiation between one's own different and those of the others. Such a separation has, from Kennedy's point of view, a radical nature. From a follow that the gain and benefit that the subject attained will only be enjoyed by them and that, in turn, the burden of losses suffered by others will only be borne by those others. The demarcation between these two types of interest is a constitutive aspect of the individualism philosophy and justify why an individual should not, in principle, carry out actions in favor of others, if there is no obligation to do so. Each agent guards their own instrument, and only those that they have agreed regarding whether or not that favor of the interests of the other individuals. This is the ontological dimension of the individualistic thesis. Kennedy, regarding of individualism, exhibit a problem with the respect to covering all the implications that are at stake and the separation of interests. Naturally, this is correct. There is a separation of one's own interests and other interests. Individual philosophy generally advocates such a demarcation, but is not an ontological question, but rather a normative one. The point of the divorce between one's own interests and other interests lies in the fact that there is a predominance of the former over the latter. This normative dimension, in my opinion, allows us to distinguish between different models as a foundation of private law. As will be seen, altruism also supposes differing between personal interests and of the others, but yet the preeminence of the one's own interest divides from it. In both perspectives of individualism, the predominance of personal interests over other interests is established, with the normative consequence of the separation of the interest. Yet these perspectives differ in the way in which the preference of self-interest is relative to the interest of the other, and the rules that ensure that general coexistence of interests are observed. Well, based on the disinterested position of individualism, the legitimacy to cause harm to third party in the pursuit of self-interest does not follow for the separation of interests. The rupture between own instrument and those of others, together with the predominance of the former, is perfectly compatible with the limitation of cancer damages and violating the interests at right of others. This not legitimacy that the individuals, for the sake and satisfaction of their needs and expectation, sacrifice of interests of others. One biggest strength of this understanding of individualism is that they are not associated with the pure defense of self-interest, while would be coherent with the selfish reading. In fact, such an observation by Kennedy when he argues that it's important to be clear from the outset that individualism is sharply distinct between pure egoism, that or the view that it is possible and desirable to set any limit at all the pursuit of self-interest. End of the note. This explains why an individual, in the interesting sense of the term, the preference of their instrument is in turn with the respect for the rules that protect the interests of the other individuals of the social body. There's no opposition between being individualistic and observing the rules established for the coexistence, with demands to avoid harming others or not undermine their expectation. Disinterest individualism is rooted in autonomy. Its normative value encourages the agent to shape their personal life plan on the basic decision freely made within the framework of the set available option. But at the same time, it requires the agent to respect the fear of the which other they deploy their autonomy, taking care not harm their rights and interests. Is the appeal of the regulative of autonomy that distinguish between the two understandings of individualism. A good reading of individualism is based on autonomy, because it has a strong affirmative moral content, the demand for respect of the right of the others. Respect for the instrument of the others naturally follows from this time of individualism, and meant the separation between the interests of the person and the preference that yield in favor of personal interests. The disinterested version of individualism is so strongly committed to the value of autonomy. Despite the influence autonomy of individualism on the normative foundation of private law and contract law, its position as unitary and common foundation can be questioned on the basis of altruism. In the case of altruism, there are also not just one way to understand it. The most widespread reading corresponds to a strong altruism, while the version presented here is moderate altruism. The first altruistic philosophy is linked with the idea of Good Samaritan. According to this, the agent must behave and in the interest of the others, renouncing their own interest. Hence, in numerous occasions, they must act directly in the interest of others and sacrifice themselves entirely. There's a clear dominance of the interests of the other personal interests. Strong altruism is based on ideas of renunciation and unlimited sacrifice in favor of the other, and for this reason, it had difficulty establishing it in moral and legal discourse. A demand formulated in this sense at first glance to be supererogative with the respect to what we can demand of each other in our social practice. The common point of both kinds of altruism is to challenge the dominance of self-interest, that is, to the question of normative consequences that is drawn from the split between self-interest and the interest of others. In this term, an altruistic view of morality reaffirms the difference between interest that is proclaimed by individualism, but, unlike individualism, reject the preference of self-interest necessary follow from that demarcation. Naturally, the way in which the two altruistic positions embody this assertion is very different. In the case of a strong altruism, the agent action are always in the service of others, but in its moderate version, it is not entirely the case, at least as it leaves men less demanding. So how the moderate altruism is characterized? It consists in following three postulates. One, the predominance of self-interest is not necessarily effective. From the division between one's own interests and those of others, the normative preference for the former to the detriment of the latter does not follow. Two, it's a permanent requirement for the agent to take into consideration and care for the interests of the other. And finally, three, it's necessary that in certain situations that the agent act in a way that is beneficial to the interest of others. As can be seen, postulate 3 relies upon a point of differentiation between two forms of altruism. While strong altruism requires the agent to subordinate this personal interest to that of others, acting systematically for the benefit of others, moderate altruism calls for a less demanding commitment on a part of the individual. In certain cases, the individual must act directly for the benefit of the other, but it's not necessary all the cases. According to moderate version of altruism, the necessity of the act in a way is a benefit to others is sensitive or to the specific circumstances and is not a duty that can be predicted on the all kind of angel conduct in general. The relevance of the altruism idea in contract law assumes that individualism isn't the significant version, fail to cover certain duties and demands that are present in this area of law. Moderate altruism is the basis for certain duty that reveal that there is something more involved that merely no harm and injuring the interests of the other in private legal practice. If this involvement of altruism is correct, then contract law cannot broadly exclusively on the individualistic canon, not even in the disinterested sense that subscribes the exclusion of the harm of the third parties. At its foundation, one needs to also take into account a strategic consideration, such as acting to benefit of others. This duty can be found in institutions of contract law, such as, for instance, the duty of renegotiate in event of the change of circumstances, of excessive onerous duty on enforcing circumstances, the duty of the contractual parties to inform with this information benefits to the other party of the contract, and in general on the positive duty of action derives from good faith that are aiming at favor the interests of the other contractual parties. Moderate altruism is, in my view, a promising candidate to challenge the thesis that the contract law is uniformly founded in individualism. It may perhaps be the case that this area of private law is characterized by the plurality rather than uniformity. The plurality is expressed, among other things, by the diversity of normative foundations that are present in this area of law. 3. Intrinsic value of contract, disinterested individualism, and moderate altruism. If it's contract that individualism, even in the most robust version, cannot be considered as the only normative foundation of contract law, the question arises, is there a tension with the substance that the detachment thesis is the intrinsic value of contract? Kimmel put forward the liberal theory of contract, his enterprise invented in the framework of the political liberalism. He sends there are commitments strongly rooted in the liberal tradition. One of them is the individualism. On this connection, Kimmel tries to dissociate this reading of liberalism for the individualistic underpainting. According to him, the understanding of liberalism as commitment to moral individualism is a mistake. By dissociating the liberal position from the individualistic normative ground, Kimmel presents is a not individualistic expression of liberalism. The author explained this approach and in the contract with the individualistic alternative as follows. The real difference between individualistic and not individualistic morality in this respect is simply that the latter draws on a much greater variety of the normative sources in defining this spectrum. End of the note. The central focus of this approach is a greater openness and flexibility of the not-individualistic version of liberalism that can accept a diversity of normative sources and by the nature of the contract bonds. Personal autonomy is indispensable but not sufficient to recognize the binding force of the contract. Not every obligation derived of the autonomous agreement can be considered in this term subject to the principle of pacta sunt servanda. For alongside the value of autonomy, there are also considerations at stake. But this not individualistic reading, which does not recognize autonomy as the only relevant element in the contract law, does not say much about the justification of the detachment between the parties. Naturally, the intrinsic value of the contract must have a place in some normative basis. And here one can well think of some reading of individualism, even if general approach is, according to Kimmel, not individualistic. In this sense, the question is whether selfish or disinterested individualism serves as a candidate for the detachment thesis. It would be hasty and unfair to Kimmel approach to link the detachment of the contractor parties to the selfish individualism. Of course, the detachment presupposes a difference between the interests of the party and the prevalence of the personal interests over those of the other. However, this value reveals a choice in the face of the dependence of on-contract relationship between on-contractor parties, and not an authorization to harm an interest of the other party. Instead, the making the contractual relationship independent of the demands of autonomy, the detachment thesis strengthens its connection and validity by means of the validity of observances the contract obligation. By increasing the contractor party's autonomy, the contractor party's connection to their demands at the same time is strengthened. As mentioned above, one of these demands is not to harm the rights or interests of the other contractor parties for the sake of satisfying one's own. Therefore, it is not possible to derive from the detachment thesis the irrelevance of the other party's interests of the absence of the concern of the interests of others. The clear commitment to autonomy that Kimmel's general position subscribed to and which is promoted in personal of the detachment thesis prevents the intrinsic value of the contract from being linked in the selfish individualism. Disinterested individualism can, to a certain extent, be regarded as not individualistic. Such an understanding is different from Kimmel's understanding, though not incompatible with it. While disinterested individualism can be commitment to other values besides autonomy, and thus be, in Kimmel's sense, not individualistic, it can also be because the dissociation itself from egoistic person and those not assume the relationship of the contractor parties of the interests of the others in the same way, since the value of autonomy also demands respect for the autonomy of the other party. The contractor party cannot harm the interests of the other party in the pursuit and benefit of their own. They may not express total indifference to the interests of the other, as if they were only concerned with the satisfaction of their own interest, and could suit aside those of the other party. From this point of view, disinterested individualism could be not individualistic. What is the interest is that detachment thesis fit with the normative underpinning on individualism is at this disoriented dimension. The contractor constitute, in Kimmel's view, an alternative to promise, and therefore the dependence maintaining personal relationship and a priori of subsequently between the contractor parties. While the agreed contractual program binds the parties, it facilitates in turn the detachment between them, because the terms are not subject or not integrated with personal ties that may take place. In accordance with the value of detachment, each party can avoid being irritated by the other contractual parties, seeking to maximize his personal interests and exercise all the rights and power that the contract and the law provide with him. These are contract and not personal relationship, such as those of affection or friendship. Therefore, in this time of relationship, they are subject to the contract. The idea of just business applies. The predominance of self-interest find no difficulty on the adaptation and the detachment between the contractor parties. On the contrary, the value of the personal detachment serves the dominance of self-interest over the interest of the other contractor party. Each party must respect the term of the contractual relationship and can derive the greatest possible benefit from the expectation and interest placed in bond. As has been said, this does not mean that the contractor party is entitled to harm the rights and interest of the other party. A distinctive feature of the individualism in the disinterested sense is opposed to selfish individualism, which seems to the Kimmel has in mind in association with more classical liberalism. Is the relationship between the pursuit of the self-interest and the respect for the interest of the others. This way of positioning the personal detachment with the individualistic foundation of a disinterested nature does allow for the accommodation of the separation between interests of the contractor parties, the preference that one own interests have over those over the other contractor party, and finally the prohibition of violating the rights and the instrument of the other party in order to satisfy one own. In this way, both the ontological and normative dimension of the disinterested individualism are verified. Up to this point, things seem moving in the same direction and can be accommodated without problems. The diagnosis varies mainly in relation to moderate altruism. If personal detachment is indeed the intrinsic value of contract, it impacts must account for the normative basis of contract law. It is therefore necessary that detachment remains in the force both of the dualistic and altruistic ground, according to dual structure has been argued for. From the dualistic point of view, in its moderate extent, each party to the contract can frame his behavior in the contract and limit his duty to those stipulated. There is nothing personal involved between them that extend the demands beyond satisfying their own interests and not harming the interests of others. Simply put, just business. However, as has been observed, the establishment of duty of the exclusive benefit of the interests of the other contractor party does not necessarily entitle moving out of the contract and into a framework of the personal relationship. Moderate altruism is not, strictly speaking, an establishment ground in contract law, but the aim is to explain the place it in fact occupies there, without need to resort a criteria outside the contract sphere. The strategy was therefore to pay attention to the contract to altruistic consideration, underline certain institution of contract law. For this kind of requirement, the interests of the other are decisive, and on various occasions, the contractual parties must not only be concerned but with the interests of the other party, but must also act directly for defending them. So it is not the difference between the parties that is challenged, but the dominance of the contractual party's personal interest. The intrinsic value of the contract cannot, therefore, exclude this altruistic duty. Such duties are demanding because they are aiming at the exclusive interest of the other party and can be traced, for example, in the duty to renegotiate in the event of the super-even hardship, in certain pre-contractual information duties, and in general, uncertain positive sub-duty to act on the basis of contractual good faith. In institution, the institution from which this claim derived from an important part of the contract law, as we traditionally know it, since their existence has a direct impact on the plausibility of the detachment thesis. Let me take the case of good faith. In the context of the secondary duties of contract, different expressions appear which, despite of not being agreed of something, even forced by the contractual parties, one of them has the duty to do something for the benefits of the other. The typology of positive sub-duty of contract in good faith involves case of action taken one by one party solely in favor of the interests of the other. A contractor party in good faith, for example, must inform to the other party about elements that are decisive for the later interest, but most also observe, if the circumstances to the case so require, duty of clarification of the basic of good faith. This doubling of the duty to inform with the duty to provide clarification can be carried out for the sole benefit to the other contractor party. In absence of this information and subsequent clarification, the later party will not suffer damage, but rather the deprivation of a direct benefit in its favor. Do assumption of this order affect the detachment thesis between the parties? This seems inevitable. The involvement of demands whose justification requires moral altruism call into the question of the dominance of the contractor party, self-interest over than the other party. It also challenged the relevance of the contractual detachment. According to Kimmel, the contract is intrinsic value in terms of the detachment it allows between the contractor parties. However, the above scenario. Can the contractor parties who possess the information and has a duty of good faith to communicate into the other party and, in turn, to make subsequent clarification, simply omit them on the grounds of just business? Faces with the infringement of this positive sub-duty of good faith, which deprived of the other party to the contractor of the benefits in the only interest, the theory of detachment provides that the hope is inadequate. It is not easy to tax reconciliation because good faith is not only mean taking into account the interests of the other contractor party, but also, under certain circumstances, acting directly in this interest. The value of detachment does suffer from cracks that Kimmel did not notice in this famous thesis. The problem is that duties of the kind are enormous, and therefore no possible to survey then across a spectrum to contractor to assess their real impact. But objective good faith is a fundamental principle of contract law, and such a general has a general application. This broad scope is in tension with the detachment thesis. If it is correct, that is the intrinsic value of the contract. On the other hand, duty of good faith establishment in favor of the interest of the party of the other party to the contract poses problems with the contractor party in the event that they increase and gradually become establishment over time in the contractual relationship. If this takes place, into cannot rule it out of the bond between the parties paradoxically becomes stronger due to the fulminate of this duty. Without having ceased the parties to the contract, and while remaining the subject of this explication and effect, standards such as trust, loyalty, and reciprocity begin to be considered a parameter of the relationship has been then flirting strength hit. There are also drawbacks on the fundamental level, because the split Kimmel outlined between the individualism he distanced himself and the not-individualism he embraced, the question is whether or not the latter is able to account for positive duties aimed to the fulfilled in the interest of the other party. For if this is not the case, then the connection between Kimmel, not individualism, and disinterested individualism is relevant and, in turn, shows an inadequacy of both the later normative model and the detachment thesis is not sufficient for the respected task of the philosophy of contract law. Regarding first issue, Kimmel, non individualistic underwriting, is on the face of it a version of disoriented individualism. It particularly lies in the celebration of the relevance of the respect and promotion of autonomy for the contractor parties. Possibly the emphasis of the diversity of normative sources alongside the personal autonomy can be aided, but their commitment and controls are very similar. The second issue relates to the chair perimeter. As we have seen, disinterested individualism incapable of the normative grounding this demand on an altruistic nature. Kimmel non-individualism, for its part, also fails to capture this beneficial duty established in favor of the other part, which go beyond the detachment between the contractor parties. The presence of the altruistic dimension from their model point of view in framework of demands to be observed by the contractor parties offers difficulties for the both moral grounds, because neither of them denies the prevalence of the personal interest over that the other interest, justifying direct action for the benefits of the latter. This common incapacity stresses the connection between the certain individualism and individualism not in individualistic reading of Kimmel. The interest angle and underline that involving the moderate altruism also generates a disruptive effect on the detachment thesis. Rules, institutions, and practice of the contract law that underlie moderate altruism consideration are not too easy to reconcile with the detachment between the parties. These are directly related to Kimmel's ambition for this future. It is about the intrinsic value of contract. However, this defining value of the contractor relationship responds easily to a normative parameter, with the disinterested individualism or not individualistic foundation for the author. But its value is dramatically different from that of altruism, even in the moderate and non-strong version of this morality. What does this kind of consideration reveals? In my view, the altruistic rationality shows the inadequacy of the altruistic normative under Python and, like Will, of the detachment thesis. When the former is not able to capture that there is something more involved in a strict duty or in the interest of the other, the latter fails to fit into the grounding provided by moderate altruism. This concerns Kimmel aspiration for although the detachment thesis, the contractor parties is, in his view, the intrinsic value of the contract. It can only be accommodated and in the individualistic foundation is a form. However, this still light of the fact that detachment cannot be distinguished before the contractor in general if the face obstacle in the all cases in which there are altruistic consideration that direct the behavior of one contractor party in favor of the other, often exceeding the duty expressly agreed by them. If it cannot, therefore, be the intrinsic value of the old contract or the contract law in general, because, in truth, it only responds to one of the normative foundations enforced there. Kimmel's thesis in this area of moral foundation of contract is commitment to the validity of single parameter, for it's not only this that the code adjusts the detachment. It seems that the not individualistic starting point was not bold enough to illuminate the normative structure of contract law in the truly non-individualistic way. I have omitted in this research interest review other critical points of the detachment thesis, such as its character of intrinsic or instrumental value of contract, its real operability in long-term contract, its possible lack of conciliation with the idea of solidarity or sociability that Daniel Markovits has defended, or its application in relational contract of Jan McNeill theory. I have concentrated on the following charge against Kimmel. If the detachment thesis were the distinctive and central feature of contract law, it is supported by and conformed to a shared individualistic foundation in the disinterested sense of the term. But if it's not true that there is only one uniform normative foundation in contract law, then Kimmel's thesis cannot be the crucial and distinctive element of the contract law. The presence of moderate altruism as a philosophical foundation offers difficulty for the detachment thesis because altruistic postulates run in the opposite direction to individualism and detachment thesis. They not only demand that the interests of the other party be taken into consideration, but also something requires the contractor party to act benefit in the interest of the other party of the contract. If it is true that moderate altruism also has a place in the foundational structure of contract law, individualism, to paraphrase Kimmel, cannot tell the whole story of contract law, nor can the detachment between the contractor party constitute the determining aspect of the contract. Is, in fact, only a part of the story. Thank you very much.